Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I personally think they should have called one of them Hewlett and the other one Packard, but that's too easy, I guess. HP tears itself asunder looking for the next big thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's a Monday. This one is the 6th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. We had HP CEO Meg Whitman on the program almost 2 years ago, and I asked her why, given that HP had two distinct customer bases, corporate technology sales and also regular customers. Why didn't she just split the company right down the middle? Here's what she said.
Listen, our view is that HP is better together at the moment and feels strongly about the turnaround path that we've laid out.
She did say in her defense at the moment, but as you know, a lot can happen in technology in 2 years. The corporate news of this Monday is, of course, the decision HP has made to split itself in two. One part to sell PCs and printers to regular people to be called HP Inc. The other to handle that business technology business. It is called Hewlett Packard Enterprises. HP is perhaps the foundational Silicon Valley company. It's been around practically forever, and therein lie the seeds of today's decision. Kate Davidson gets us going.
HP's CEO Meg Whitman says the two new companies will have better focus. One will focus on personal computers and printers. The other will focus on the enterprise space of the cloud, servers, and data storage. And HP is not the only old tech company that's been refocusing.
One example that comes to mind is IBM.
Craig Stice is an analyst with IHS.
They split off their PC business to Lenovo so they could focus more on their server and software packages.
And he says IBM recently sold a server hardware business to Lenovo as well. In short, says analyst Angelo Zeno with S&P Capital IQ.
The day and age when we've got these big bellwether conglomerate names in the tech space are pretty much over and done with.
Zeno says HP's stodgier PC and printer business was holding back its enterprise growth.
So the cloud is really where a lot of the tech names are really trying to migrate towards and trying to focus on, because you're starting to really see some acceleration of growth within the cloud category.
Think of it this way. The house of tech has many mansions, but they don't all have synergies. Morningstar analyst Pete Wahlstrom says HP wants to invest more in the cloud, a fast-growing and rapidly changing market.
When HP saw the, let's say, printer business, there weren't too many synergies with the cloud business.
Splitting off, he says, will allow the new Hewlett Packard Enterprise to invest big money in big data projects without compromising the day-to-day needs of HP's other mansions. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
HP shares today, by the way, ticker symbol HPQ. Email us if you know where the Q comes from. Anyway, shares up 4.74% today for HP. From the world of sports today, a quick glimpse at the future of television. Speaking of which, our series of the same name resumes a little bit later on in today's broadcast. But back to sports, this news, courtesy of the National Basketball Association. The NBA has reached a new deal with broadcasters that stretches through the year 2025. One part of that arrangement lets ESPN stream some games online to customers, whether they have a cable subscription or not. Or perhaps to simplify things a little bit, ESPN wants a more direct relationship with you the humble viewer. There are, as always with these deals, though, some caveats. Nova Sappho reports.
ESPN's move into live digital streaming is a baby step, and we don't really know yet in what direction.
What ESPN doesn't want to do is compete with itself.
Peter Kafka covers media and technology for the online magazine Recode. He says ESPN will likely live stream some NBA games, such as ones it's not broadcasting, on one of its TV channels.
But what you're not going to be able to do is sort of watch a full suite of NBA games without getting ESPN.
And without paying for a cable TV package. That's because for ESPN, its cable channels are its cash cow. At a Recode conference last month, ESPN CEO John Skipper signaled that this latest move is part of the company's future.
We have two big revenue streams, payments from distributors, advertising. We think about, are there sports events we could offer that the consumer would pay us directly?
In other words, a third revenue stream.
It is incumbent on the NBA and on ESPN to reach audiences that are attractive to advertisers.
Rebecca Lieb is a media analyst at Altimeter Group. She says among the most attractive and hard-to-reach audience for advertisers are young men. The young male demographic is increasingly cutting the cable cord, and yet if they try to live stream a sports game today, they'd need a cable TV plan.
What I see in this deal is the beginning of a kind of uncoupling of that.
Leap says expect other pay TV networks, such as HBO and Showtime, to also take some baby steps away from cable. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Other than Hewlett-Packard, HPQ, on your ticker, Wall Street today was not a whole lot going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The NBC cameraman infected with Ebola arrived at a hospital in Nebraska today. And in Dallas, Texas, Thomas Eric Duncan remains in critical condition. Healthcare is, as we all know, a business. And while this is nobody's idea of the perfect case study, what happens when a hospital takes on a patient with a disease like this? From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports.
The past few days, there has been no wait at Texas Health Presbyterian's emergency room in Dallas. Usually, it takes about 45 minutes to see a doctor. A week after a patient confirmed to have Ebola came through the ER, it's not the most popular place.
If I lived in Dallas and became ill, I would head straight for the Texas Health ER, knowing that the waiting lines are so short.
Dr. Albert Wu is professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins. He says the hospital is probably on high alert.
I would bet that Texas Health is a safer hospital and their ED is safer than the other hospitals that they would otherwise compete with.
Still, concerns about Ebola could have a short-term effect on business. There are more than 80,000 visits to the ER at Texas Health Presbyterian each year. On average, an ER visit brings in anywhere from $150 to $1,000. In revenue. That might not sound like a lot, but
you just multiply that by the number of patients that are not coming, and that dramatically affects both the hospital and the group's bottom line.
Dr. Angelo Falcone is CEO of Medical Emergency Professionals, which staffs emergency departments in Maryland and Connecticut. He says the real financial loss isn't from not treating a broken arm or prescribing pills. It's from not admitting a patient. Nearly half of hospital patients come through the ER. When you lose one of those customers, it's expensive.
Then we talk about tens of thousands of dollars of potential revenue that's lost.
Falcone says people probably won't avoid the hospital permanently, and fluctuations in patient numbers comes with the territory.
It's the nature of the beast in emergency medicine is that you'll have some days where all of a sudden all the patients show up, and you'll have other days where it's not quite as crazy.
In the long run, Alex Wu at Johns Hopkins says Texas Health Presbyterian could actually benefit.
I'm not sure that they're going to make their reputation on we do the best job curing Ebola cases, send them to us. But they are getting their name mentioned, and in the end, that might not be a terrible thing.
Right now, we just have the hospital's symptoms. The prognosis is uncertain. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Members of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra are locked out, unable to reach an agreement with management for the second time in as many years. Talks are now taking place through a federal mediator, but what's happening isn't unique to Atlanta. Orchestras in Indianapolis, Philadelphia, Louisville, and Nashville have each had contract and budget issues as well. Because why? From WABE in Atlanta, Michelle Alloy reports.
Think of an orchestra player like a professional athlete.
You have these incredibly uniquely talented people. They deserve more money.
That's Tom Smith, an economist at Emory University's Goizueta School of Business. But whereas pro sports teams usually have packed stadiums, orchestras are struggling because of aging audiences and lagging ticket sales. So that's the problem, right? Well, sure, says Smith, but it's more complicated than that.
A team like the Chicago Bulls, Atlanta Hawks, maybe 35% of their revenue comes from ticket sales. So just filling the seats doesn't help the Hawks pay for their salaries and their players.
Smith says orchestras suffer from something called cost disease. Think of a string quartet. There always have to be four players, and it takes them the same amount of time to play a piece today as it did 100 years ago. But the costs associated with that performance, paying the players, renting a venue, promotion, those increase over time. Robert Flanagan is a professor at Stanford University and wrote a book on the economics of symphony orchestras.
Most people who work in the performing arts expect their pay to increase roughly at the same rate as pay in the rest of the economy. But unlike the rest of the economy, the labor requirements for putting on a performance don't change.
To a lesser extent, sports teams suffer from the same economic affliction. It still takes 10 players to play a basketball game that's four quarters long. But sports teams have billion-dollar broadcasting deals, stadium naming rights, and merchandise sales to round out their budgets. Orchestras don't have that luxury. Flanagan says here's where declining demand comes into play. Fewer large donors. But Emory's Tom Smith says even when big donations do come in, they often come with a catch.
People aren't usually just going to give you money and say, oh, here's $1 million and go ahead, use it to pay the salary of your violin players. They're going to say, I want a building and I want a building with my name on it.
And that's led to the downsizing of orchestras, including Atlanta's. 2 years ago, the players agreed to salary cuts and the elimination of seven positions. But cuts come with their own consequences, as musicians will leave for spots at bigger orchestras that haven't had to make the same cuts. So what's a struggling orchestra to do? Symphony consultant Daryl Edwards says today's orchestras may need to diversify their music, opting for more of a mix of popular music and symphony classics.
The orchestras that are doing well are doing both. And it's not to take away from the importance of orchestras playing the masterworks, because that's how they really grow artistically.
Which leaves orchestra directors in a tricky spot. Do they play the score from Star Wars for the upteenth time to bring in people, or play something new that may not appeal to a wide audience? Edwards says it's a decision many directors may be reluctant to make. In Atlanta, I'm Michelle Alloy for Marketplace.
Coming up, you put your show online for free, so how do you make money?
You show an ad on YouTube, you get a cut. We have merchandise. We have affiliate marketing, which is we link to something for off of the site, we get a cut if that sale is made. We have DVDs.
Oh, so a lot of ways then. All right. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 17 points on a quiet Monday. It's a 10th percent, closed at 16,991. The NASDAQ off 20 points, nearly a half percent, finished at 4,454. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points, more than a 10th percent, ended things at 1964. HP, you know about, up about 4.75%. Elsewhere in the world of technology, Apple's partner in a glass plant in Arizona, GT Advanced Technology, said it filed for bankruptcy. The company's scratch-resistant glass is not part of the new big-screen iPhone. Shares in GT down a staggering 92%. Apple shares flat on the day. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 2.41%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for August. The Nobel Prize in Physics is announced tomorrow. And looking forward to Halloween candy? Well, here is something you can have now. Cheese! October is American Cheese Month. It can be celebrated wherever there is cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's looking like this year's corn crop is going to be a biggie. A record harvest is set to come in, and that is just terrible news for corn farmers. Oversupply means underwhelming prices, but there is a backstory to what seems at first blush to be just another setup for just another piece about the laws of supply and demand. Because corn, the biggest crop we have in this country, isn't really food. It's actually a highly refined industrial material, more like aluminum than apples. Marketplace's Dan Weissman starts Corn Economics 101 at an ethanol plant.
Eric Hackmiller is showing me around the ethanol plant he runs, Lincoln Way Energy in Nevada, Iowa. Big buildings, loud noises, and unexpected smells. What's this one?
What you smell is residual CO2 and cooking of very much like a bakery smell.
Yeah, bread baking. And then Hackmiller opens the door to a giant, giant building with a corrugated metal roof.
Oh my gosh.
It's a barn. Inside are these golden mountains, piled up flakes of grain. Every bushel of corn that comes to Lincoln Way Energy, only a third comes out as ethanol. Another third comes out as carbon dioxide, which goes into soda pop. The rest, the fat, fiber, and protein, ends up on one of these piles.
Each pile being about 1,000 tons.
That's one day's worth of this stuff. It's called distiller's grains.
It's good food for cows, chickens, and pigs.
And most important, it's cheap.
For animal feeding, you feed the lowest cost to get the most growth out of the animals. So everything has to price itself into the ration because a cow doesn't say, I'm eating Italian tonight. He's got to eat whatever he gets fed.
And if he's in a feedlot where most cows gain half their body weight, he's probably eating corn, either distiller's grains or the whole kernel. And we are not. We wouldn't recognize it. Chris Edgington has been growing corn for decades. Here's what his corn isn't.
It is not the corn you eat off the cob. It is not the corn that's in the can. It's not the frozen corn that's in the bag. It is not that product.
That product, sweet corn, is a different crop and a lot smaller. Last year, for every pound of sweet corn, U.S. farmers grew more than 250 pounds of field corn, which goes to farm animals. If you are what you eat, they are, more than anything else, corn. So when we eat a ham and cheese omelet, that's mostly corn. Joseph Glauber is chief economist of the United States Department of Agriculture.
It's a fairly small component of other foods. I mean, people look at things like high fructose corn syrup, but...
You know how much of the corn crop goes to corn syrup? 3.5%. A little less than that goes to other sugars plus alcohol for vodka. Actual corn-type food, Doritos, Jiffy cornbread mix, cornflakes... That's 1.5% of the corn crop. And for stuff we eat and drink, that's about it. Other than as a low-cost ration for animals, the big use for corn is ethanol. And ethanol has been booming since 2000. There's 8 times as much now. That's been great for corn farmers because they have so much corn to get rid of. Monty Shaw runs the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. That's the state's ethanol lobby.
The joke in farm country has always been that, you know, if you give a farmer a market, he'll overproduce it. And quite frankly, for over 200 years, that's been pretty true, except for these last 8 years, when ethanol sucked up that extra corn production.
Extra production is not 1 year's bumper crop. And it's not just the extra acres that got planted after the ethanol boom. It is a long-term constant. Productivity, the yield from 1 acre of cornfield, has been ratcheting up for decades and decades. So 2012, terrible drought. Worst yields in more than 15 years, productivity was more than twice as high as any year before 1960, which puts the whole food versus fuel thing in a new light. We plant more than 90 million acres of corn, and it's in huge surplus, and it's not even food. What if we planted actual food instead? Bruce Babcock is a corn economist at Iowa State.
Our ability to supply the world with vegetables is practically unlimited.
Take corn, add in other giant crops that basically just feed animals, soybeans, looking at you, and 2/3 of U.S. farmland goes to animal feed. We all go vegan and...
There would be such a surplus of farmland in the United States to grow kumquats and pecans that we'd be awash in those in a heartbeat.
The UN says we'll have 10 billion people on Earth by 2100. Could we feed them?
We would have more land available for the 10 billion than they would know what to do with.
But we don't. Thank markets.
That's not what consumers want. As they get more money, they want to eat meat.
So farmers plant corn. In Iowa, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
You can see where all that corn actually goes and how much of it ends up on your plate. And special bonus, a video of one of those ginormous mountains of grain that Dan visited, all on our website, marketplace.org. We've been spending some time the past couple of weeks, as I mentioned earlier, on television. How it gets made, how we're watching it, and what its future might be. It's a series we're calling Screen Wars.
Television.
Got this.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note,
commercial break.
Television today on the much smaller screen. A company that makes shows, programming is the jargony phrase, that appear on YouTube. Pemberley Digital, right here in Los Angeles, is best known for a web series called The Lizzie Bennet Diaries, which, as you will know if you're up on your Jane Austen, is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. It got millions of views. It also won an Emmy. Their latest is Frankenstein MD, adapted from, yes, Frankenstein. Bernie Sue is the executive producer of both shows. Bernie, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
What is it for you about telling stories in 4 or 5 minute chunks?
I think it speaks to our modern culture, I guess, like the what they call the ADD culture.
Yeah.
People want to get in and get out and get in and get out. And so what's challenging for that format for us when you're talking about a long story, like mm-hmm. a grand narrative,
right.
like a Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, Lizzie Bennet, Lizzie Bennet, Pride and Prejudice,
yeah.
whatever, yeah.
Exactly. It's that you're finding ways to insert and come out of like, you know, cliffhangers and stuff in these kind
yeah.
of 4 to 5 minute increments. So it makes it like a really exciting roller coaster when we're doing it right.
Talk to me for a second about the business model. Not to be crass, but how do you guys make money?
For our series, we make money in actually a lot of different ways.
All right.
Yeah, we like to look at it as the company Pemberley Digital, we design franchises. We don't just adapt books, we turn them into franchises. So we'll take Lizzie Bennet first because that's the one that has the longest shelf life.
Right. And it is, just to remind people, it's Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice.
The format is a video log, right?
Video blog, yeah. You have the main character, Lizzie Bennet, walking through her narrative as a blogger
right.
or a diary or what you want to call it. And the characters, Mr. Darcy and everybody else, kind of come into her life, whether on camera or off. As far as monetization there were 5 ways that Lizzie Bennet made money. You show an ad on YouTube, you get a cut.
Right.
That's the YouTube partner program. They've been doing that for 7 years. We have merchandise. Lizzie Bennet pins, as a mug, there's t-shirts, there's posters. We have affiliate marketing, which is if we link to something off of the site, we get a cut if that sale is made. We have DVDs.
Yeah.
DVD of the show that's still available for free online.
which is how I watched it, I will confess.
Yes, that's fine.
But I watched the ad, so it's okay.
It's perfectly fine, but the DVDs, is we've sold, I believe, up to date now, 7,000 units. So, again, for a show that's available free online.
Which is amazing.
And finally, there was a book called The Secret Diary of Lizzie Bennet. It's told from a similar perspective, but instead of Lizzie video blogging, she's like writing a actual diary as she's going through her journey, and thus making the franchise a book based on the web series,
which
based
is based on
the
a book.
Book.
Yeah, that, which is very meta, but that's a whole different deal. Do you find it tricky that your products, your shows, are judged on like the first 4 minutes, maybe the first 8 minutes, right? The first 2 episodes.
Oh, wow.
As opposed to like a movie where somebody's, you know, going to pay $12 and go sit in there and stick through the whole 2 hour thing.
That's very astute. That's a very astute question.
Wow.
And you're right. It is. You are right. It's something I worry about a lot. If you watch the first episode and you go and you watch it and you pass your judgment on that first episode, you have to make a choice. You're like, I would want to watch the second episode. Yeah. Do I want to click away to something else? Do I want to check my email? So inherently, you're judging one of the greatest works
of
fiction,
right. Yeah, exactly.
On one half of chapter one.
Right.
What format has us do that? None.
Yeah.
No other format does that. Like you said, you're in a movie, you buy a ticket, you're sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, and the first episode of Lizzie Bennet is 4 minutes. I mean, some cinematic movies, that's the credits.
That's right. So, that's right. Well, I mean, I'll tell you. So I was watching Lizzie Bennet, and mm-hmm. I stuck through 3 episodes mm-hmm. and left really only because I got busy.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I had things to do and meetings and whatever.
That's your thing.
But it's also not geared for me, right? I mean, I'm not the target audience for this.
You don't seem like a 25 and under female.
No, I'm not.
Okay. Right.
So, I mean, is it tough sort of honing that and crafting that and narrowing it down?
Sure.
Because you know what? You're not an under 25-year-old female either, by the way.
I am not. Certainly am not. I guess in the modern kind of age of content, there's so much democratization. Mm-hmm. I am what I am. You are where you are. You watch what you watch. I watch what I watch. It's not like, oh, we're buddies. We're all going to watch the same thing together every time. Right. We don't do that anymore. So you craft it to the niche. The internet has given the niche the power. So our niche is not just 2,500 female for Lizzie Bennet. It's 2,500 literary or educational-minded right. females. So we don't try to compete with the beauty gurus or the fashionistas. They do their thing. They're great. You know, keep doing it. We're going to do our thing, and we're gonna play to the lit mind a little more.
Lit mind. Good word. Bernie Hsu from Pemberley Digital. Bernie, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
There is more of our series, Screen Wars, and links to the Lizzie Bennet Diaries at Marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which will take the form of a very brief quiz of the following 4 people, which one runs the Federal Reserve? That was a question in the most recent Pew News IQ survey, and the answer choices were Janet Yellen, correctly picked by 24% of people. John Roberts, 5% of people. Sonia Sotomayor, 6% of people. And this one, which was, quite honestly, the troubling part, Alan Greenspan, not one but 2 chairmen ago, 17%. Nowhere in that, by the way, Ben Bernanke. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow gave back 17 points, a 10%. The NASDAQ off 20 points, nearly a 0.5%. The S&P 500 shed 3 points, more than a 10%. Don't know, by the way, on that survey, that was 48% of people. Don't know who runs the Fed. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.